Hello, Spencer. I'm going to talk a bit about borders. Have you ever wondered why it was so easy to love things when we were kids? We gave our hearts to everything that mattered to us. We invested ourselves emotionally in every story and whim of our imagination. We talked to people we'd never met as if they were our best friends. What happened to us along the way? Is the difference in the way we love just the natural result of changes that happen when we grow up? Not entirely, I think. The difference in the way we love has to do with the borders that we've erected between ourselves and others. We figured out somewhere early on in our childhood that people would judge us for what we love. We realized slowly that to love was to be vulnerable. I remember when I was in second grade, I used to talk all the time with my friends about Pokemon. It was something that I loved immensely, and so did they, and we had a lot of fun pretending to find Pokemon on the playground during recess. But then other kids started to make fun of us. So what did we do? We stopped. We put a border between ourselves and the thing that we loved so that we would stop loving it. The same thing happens whenever we invest ourselves in something that can let us down. Perhaps there was a time that you were young and you shared something deeply personal with someone who you thought was a friend, and then they shared it with everyone else. What do you do after something like that happens? You restrain yourself. You tell yourself, never again will I trust someone so readily. A wall is erected that prevents you from throwing yourself into the people and the things that you love. And now, if a person wants to get to you, if they want to know you personally, they have to first deconstruct that wall brick by brick. So now the question is, why do we make these walls? We make these walls because we don't want to feel pain. We make these walls because we're ashamed, and we've forgotten what it feels like to love something vulnerably. We've underestimated the value of a vulnerable love and have valued it less than other people's opinions of us. This is not to say that other people's opinions and feelings don't matter, but we judge each other enough for the things that we do wrong to also judge people for what and who we love. We also make these walls because we don't want to see pain. We know where the need is, but we take routes, whether they be physical or mental, that we know will not pass by the places where there is pain. Or sometimes, when we cannot avoid taking these routes, we step a little farther to the other side of the road. How many times have we read about the Good Samaritan, and how many times have we been appalled by the priest or the Levite walking by the other side of the road? But we do this too, both physically and mentally. We do the very thing that we think is appalling. We avoid encountering the need. It's not that we don't want to see the need fulfilled. It's that if we're going to fulfill the need, we would still rather maintain the border between ourselves and that need. This might be a bit harsh, but I think it's why we love canned food drives, because it gives us an outlet through which we can help people without having to meet the people we are helping. And I add to this, please, please do bring all the cans you want for canned food drives. It's a very good thing. But this is not about the good we're doing, it's about the good we're not doing. When we see the need, when we see the abused man on the side of the road, we think to ourselves, there is someone more appropriate than me to deal with this. There is someone with better resources to deal with this. There is someone who is better at wading deep into the ugly places than I am. But that's probably what the priest was thinking, right? He probably wasn't justifying himself by saying, I shouldn't help this man. No, he was much more likely thinking, there's someone out there who can afford to get unclean more than I can, and that person will do something about this. But here's the really important takeaway. The people who do something about the need, who are willing to wade deep into it, are not doing it because they think they're better at it than other people. They're doing it because to them, it's not an ugly place at all. They've seen the beauty in that place, and they want to bring it out into the light. The Good Samaritan saw in the suffering man humanity, worthiness, beauty, and behaved towards him as he would behave towards those things. We serve people. We make sacrifices for friends, for spouses, for family, because we have more faith in them than they do in themselves. And it should be the same way with whomever we're serving, even a stranger, even in the case of the Good Samaritan, a foreigner. I want to also clarify something about what this means for us by mentioning a revelation given to me by Tracy Howell, who used to lead Eucharist here at Westminster. And I think Tracy might have gotten it from Denise Anderson, who's the co-moderator of the Presbyterian Church. I'm not quite sure. But she was talking about something other than borders, but I think I can apply what she said to borders. What she said was this: white supremacy hurts white people too. And she went on to explain that prejudice doesn't just hurt those being discriminated against, but also those engaging in discrimination, because it prevents them from living in the fullness of God's image. It locks them into enmity where there could have been love and equality. It's the pain of a lost opportunity. And I think this translates well into the issue of borders. The borders we make to prevent us from feeling and seeing pain, they don't just hurt others, they hurt us too. When we take the easy road, we miss some beautiful sights. When we avoid working with strangers, we miss out on transformative relationships. When we wall ourselves in, we never discover the tender caretaker or the sacrificial servant that is Christ in us. We're incomplete. I often think about the original Thanksgiving in relation to this. Nowadays, celebrating Thanksgiving means eating food you know well with the people you know well. But the original Thanksgiving must have been quite something. It was one of those few times in history when people who were separate realized that through peaceful coexistence and the breaking down of borders, greater abundance could be achieved. The scary thing is that whatever that magical moment was like, it wasn't able to last. People who have a revelation find it hard not to sink back into old prejudices. Different people are indeed different, and constructing a border often seems easier than embracing diversity. So what do we do? First, we open ourselves up, trusting that greater abundance will result. And second, we look for Jesus. We look for Jesus in the stranger asking for help. We look for Jesus in the foreigner whose ways we can't at first understand. We look for Jesus in that person we can't get along with because they do things differently than us. And we serve them, all those people. We serve them like we would serve our closest friend. Because when we serve the least of these, when we invite the stranger in, we're not just embodying Christ, we are also serving Christ. Thank you very much, Westminster, for 4 years of community and support. You've meant a whole lot to me, and I will miss you. Thank you.
When my sister and I were little, she got a wooden toy car for Christmas. It was without pedals. You simply sat on the seat and pushed off the floor with your toes to drive it, which was perhaps an excellent design because it was impossible to ever really get going even slightly fast. The working horn was also later recalled and replaced with a horn that did not even slightly work, which became another parent-friendly design element. But the thing I remember most about it was that every time you did work up enough speed to get from one end of the room to the doorway of the next, you'd get stuck on the door sill. Back then, I thought that was terribly frustrating, as adult people with adult cars are often frustrated by frequent speed bumps. As a person close to adulthood myself, I know I feel this. And yet, with a miniature axle on either side of the doorway, there was always a certain continued exhilaration. Here was a situation we'd gotten ourselves into, suspended mid-race on the threshold, and one sister would have to come push the other sister through the door all the way. In a state of uncertainty, we'd rely on the other to come, sitting there peacefully waiting. My professor, Gregory Orr, talks about thresholds as a kind of clarity in the ceaseless and disordered nature of experience. It's a matter of how much order we need to feel safe, and yet how much disorder we need to feel vitally alive, he says. Here I would be, plastic wheels ceased in all ways, knowing that my sister's soft younger child feet would pad up behind me, and that she'd put the heels of her palms by my shoulder blades, lean down almost horizontally, and push with all her small might. The same little sister, who is now studying to be a classics major, and also a rescue helicopter surgeon linguistic warrior of the wilderness, also recently told me that the Latin word for threshold was limen, like subliminal. She said, "The psalm for today speaks of the sense of knowing that God has for us, even before we are born, even on the far side of the sea, that there is something innate inside of us that is fearfully and wonderfully made, undetectable, below the limit." Because I'd like to keep up Reverend Henry's tradition of Emily Dickinson and his recent talks and sermons, here is one of my favorites. "Dare you see a soul at the white heat, then crouch within the door. Red is the fire's common tint, but when the vivid ore has sated flame's conditions, its quivering substance plays without a color, but the light of unanointed blaze. Least village boasts its blacksmith, whose anvil's even din stands symbol for the finer forge that soundless tugs within, refining these impatient ores with hammer and with blaze, until the designated light repudiate the forge." The borders we make within ourselves, between each other, are often fearfully and wonderfully made too. We keep parts of us hidden from even our own knowing, and yet God knows us. We divide ourselves from others so subconsciously, senselessly. And it is too good to be true to say that we do not also at times hate our enemies. As some of you know, I'm gay. I have enemies built in. I stood on the threshold of that realization for a long time, knowing and yet drawing up new walls, new higher doorways between what I knew about myself and what had been known since before I was born, perhaps back in the depths of the earth, that secret place. It took so long to tell the sister who used to pull me out from between door jams as she sat on her kitchen stool, I on mine. We do not always want the borders we make. They are fearfully made. And yet, our oars are impatient, and sooner or later we repudiate our forges because there is no other choice. Walls will always come down. Even as they are built, they are known in their weaving together and their unweaving. There is nowhere that any wall can flee. In the bed of the depths, God is there. I've been a part of this congregation since I was a baby. I was baptized in front of these steps. I joined the choir when I was in kindergarten. I turned 13 somewhere along the way. I went back to the choir room at 20 to help teach the choristers as I had been taught. And then all of a sudden, this Friday, I was 22. And I realized that I am standing now on the threshold between Charlottesville, between you, and the next part of whatever I will live out. I have been knit together. I have been forged by this whole place, by every person here, perhaps even subliminally. And I want to tell you I am grateful to you. And I dare you now to see your soul to the white heat, however that is known to you and to God, to crouch within the door. Because there, at our borders, standing atop our walls, we can see for great distances on either side.